couple more minutes here. Is there any, you said you wanted an additional item there added to the agenda?
I just wanted to bring up something for discussion and possible action.
Okay, yeah, we can bring that in there, I guess. Part of the reason we're here, I guess, is being a legislator had a bill that is sitting in committee. It got tabled about dredge gear through oyster sanctuaries. So that's part of the reason. And then the other items on the agenda are, you know, we're having a meeting a little early than we normally do, so figure get started on this early. It's my first go as the replenishment officer here, so get an early start. And I don't anticipate any major changes this year, but with that, is that Dan there?
That's me.
Hi, Dan.
It's Dave.
Whoever you.
So if you want, we can make a little brief introduction. I know most of you here, but I'm Andrew Button. I took over for Jim Wesson here as of this year, and so I know everybody here. So I guess we can get started there, and we'll jump right into it. So part of what we're here to do is figure out the sanctuary issue again. The full commission addressed the prohibition on dredge gear through sanctuaries there back at the January committee, January commission meeting. And basically that was in the Rappahannock River area. We adjusted the maps. We didn't take any further action in that. And sort of a background on how our sanctuaries work in this area in particular. All of these sanctuaries, just what makes them a sanctuary in the regulations, is they basically just have a no harvesting sign up there on buoys in combination with some more permanent pilings or structures that are there. And when the signage is up, which we really only maintain during the active harvest season because we're not in the business of being a buoy tender fleet, relatively small staff, that's when they become actual sanctuaries in regulation and have that sort of added protection of the sanctuary area. And the commission thought that in the Rappahannock, at least, changing the map so that it's clear, you can see these are actually the buoys. Right there, those are actually buoys that we maintain. And other areas are just sort of imaginary lines outside of the harvest area. And the map is basically there for harvesters sort of reference. And if there's actually any buoys there that are around the sanctuary, then that would actually have regulatory protection of the sanctuary. And the commission took no further action other than adjusting the map on this. And we're fine with that. This is the other areas of sanctuary. There's six of them, and only one of them is on the western shore, and it's the Rex Shoals James River Oyster Sanctuary, and it's actually in regulatory statute, and the boundaries are listed out, so that's sort of a more permanent sanctuary. So even when there's in the harvest season or outside of the public harvest season, this would still maintain a sanctuary. There's a prohibition of dredge gear, patent tong, hand scrape gear. You're allowed to cross it currently with hand tongs on board as long as there's no oysters on board. And the advisory committee was asked to address this issue based on, is it an undue inconvenience to watermen, the sanctuary, or is it, basically worth having an added layer of protection there to make sure that no one's getting into these areas with the dredge? I mean, at the previous commission meeting, we had a waterman under oath testify to catching 17 bushels of oysters in less than 20 minutes in the Rex Shoals Sanctuary. So it's a fragile area. There's been a lot of science that's gone on there. I hope that this committee sort of has put the sanctuary issue to rest to a certain extent. And, I'd like to see personally support for maintaining it as it is, the Rex Shoals Sanctuary. But that's sort of open for discussion. And I'd like to hear from you guys as to what you think about any change to the sanctuary designation.
Well, I for one don't agree with the regulation that you should not pass through those areas. I have several reasons why not. I have oystered in James River, and I'm familiar with it from a lifetime of experience, not only oystering, but having served on the Virginia Marine Resources Commission for a number of years. If you're oystering in James River, and even when you are tonguing oysters, you get wind and tide conditions at times, particularly now that a lot of the watermen are harvesting in smaller boats like the Carolina skiffs and so forth, that you don't need to have to go in a particular direction to get to your harbor, because you could take the sea on the stern of your boat or on the side of your boat, and you could get swamped if you had to sail in a particular direction to go around the sanctuary. That's one concern that I would have. And it doesn't make any sense to me that because we have one or two eight laws that would harvest in the sanctuary or make a few licks in the sanctuary or whatever, that you'd have to put these people's lives in jeopardy when the weather conditions are such that you can't readily sail across these sanctuaries. It just doesn't make any sense. I know firsthand that the sanctuary in the James River is not adequately marked, so that you know absolutely that you're in the sanctuary and out of the sanctuary. And so with that in mind, I don't know how you would be certain that you were outside the sanctuary, particularly if you were in conditions unfavorable to sailing in an exact direction to keep you out of the sanctuary, depending on where you're harvesting and so forth. Additionally, it's been a long time since data was accumulated to justify having a sanctuary at Rack Shoals at all. Some years ago, when it was initially set up, there were current data to support having a sanctuary there. I haven't seen any recent studies since the idle fleet has been reduced, since the global warming situation and the tidal conditions and so forth in the James River to justify having such a large sanctuary in the James River. And this has been debated several times on this committee. And the necessity of a sanctuary, if it exists, the necessity of a sanctuary in that area, which I question, personally question, having been familiar with the data and information over a lifetime now. But if it does exist, then it needs to be updated. With all the different environmental conditions and with all the different structures. It used to be held that the James River tidal flow was in a gyro shaped that essentially went down to Hampton Roads, and most of the spat, the outfall of larvae in the James River actually came from the lower part of the river and even from Hampton Roads and moved up in that gyro effect to the upper river. And I don't know whether that condition, whether the scientists still subscribe to that or not, but back in the day when that was set up, that was the information they were using to justify a sanctuary at Rack Shoals.
Just a little clarification there. This is, the red box there is the current size of the sanctuary. It's about 740 acres. It's a little bit more than a mile and a half across. The green box that you see there is the old size of the sanctuary. It was over 5,000 acres, so it's already been shrunk considerably.
Yeah. Well,
and this area in particular has the most scientific data. We have continually monitored it. And that's part of the reason for keeping it, is if something does go wrong in the James River, which I'm sure, as all of you know, has and always hopefully will be one of the most oyster-producing rivers in Virginia, we have something to look back and see if we've gone wrong.
Over the years, it's been the most
Well, you can
a
see
productive
this,
area in the world.
Well, you can see this is the blue there is the last 3 years of harvest coming out of the James River, 1.2 million bushels of oysters. The red is entire rest of Virginia. That includes aquaculture. So right now the James River is working very well, and I think we can all acknowledge that. But I'm hesitant to make any major changes to the sanctuary area.
If something goes wrong in James River, it's not going to be reading those sanctuary signs, I can promise you that.
Well, you're right, but, you know, if you do adjust the sanctuary and it does change, I mean, it's not broken right now. It's working very well. I don't think the sanctuary is causing an undue hardship in terms of a navigational hazard. It's a mile and a half across, you know, but go ahead.
I support the concept of the sanctuary, and I would personally would not want to see it changed. Maybe it would be good to have Roger Mann come and next time we meet and just discuss that, give us an update. And as far as the safety issue, I would have to agree. Being in a 21 or 24-foot Carolina skiff, these guys are coming in with their limit. So if there's three guys on there, what's that, 36 bushels? There's not much freeboard there. So maybe the answer is law enforcement. I know when I was oystering in the Potomac River, all we had to know was that the notorious MPO up there, Rick Carroll, was about, and we didn't mess around. So maybe it's just as simple as having a law enforcement boat out there during the times that they're working in and around the sanctuary. I don't know how law enforcement guys feel about that, but if there's a boat out there, people are less likely to do wrong, I would think. I would like to see the guys be able to go across the sanctuary with their gear. It's no skin off my back. I don't have a dog in the fight. But so I personally wouldn't have any problem with him going across, as long as there's adequate law enforcement to police it.
With dredge gear or Anton?
Either one.
They're going to write him a ticket for traveling across it. They can write him a ticket for work, and they're going to have to be there either way. So I mean, the law enforcement issue, again. It's a moot point if no law enforcement's there because they can ride wherever they want. Nobody can write them up for it. So, I mean, that's irregardless of what the rule is.
Have they got the corners of it marked? Is it adequately marked?
Well, we have no harvesting signs in the buoys there.
Tell them what the distance is between those two points on the far left.
Well, the whole sanctuary and the
widest. No, just that one line. Tell them what the distance is there, please.
Right here?
Yes, from there to the one on the bottom. What's
right there?
Yeah, what's the distance?
I have
one on the left.
There's a map of the scale right there.
Well, that's probably a quarter mile, isn't it?
The smallest, if you go across the top there, the widest point on the sanctuary from the furthest distance you can go is about 1.7 miles across.
Okay, so you get 1.7 miles, you've got two points. When you come through the middle, how do you know where that line is when your corners are 1.7 miles away, is the question I've got for you.
It's hard to determine.
Well, that's exactly correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly correct. So that's the point when he's saying it's not marked adequately, just so that you understand.
Are there poles on those?
Yeah,
there's poles on them ends 1.7 miles away. And, you know, I've got markers on my ground every 200 yards, and it's hard to tell where the line is when you have them every 200 yards, much less 1.7 miles.
It's pretty easy to tell when you're crossing the sanctuary if you're following the normal navigational beacons that are in the river. That's part of why it's right there. As you see, it goes from that red nun that red nun right there. So if you have sort of basic navigational competence to know where the channel is, you know when you're crossing the sanctuary boundary.
Andy, if I've got a Carolina skiff, I've got to go around that fall buoy to get into the harbor at Minchville and a loaded Carolina skiff. That's not right. You know, if you're tonguing oysters up the river, to get in Minchville Harbor, you got to go around the channel markers is what you're advocating.
Well, you can go right through here. If you look on the chart, there's plenty of water for a skiff to go behind the sanctuary. I don't honestly feel that. I mean, if there was a matter of life and death and you were going to get swamped if you couldn't cut across the sanctuary, I think there could be some reasonable accommodation made there. But
I've got a couple ideas that, you know, the people in the scallop industry out in the ocean, they're not permitted to go through an area unless they have their gear situated where they can't be used. And an example would be like if you have, if you're pulling a dredge and you've got a boom sitting up there, if instead of you having that line tied to your dredge, you could have it tied to a basket and hoisted up to the top of the boom where anybody could see that they can't pull a dredge because a basket hops off to the boom. But there's a couple of other issues that I'd like to bring to your attention. And one being with 1,600 acres of oyster beds and me planting 40,000 bushels of seed every year since 2014, and I'm just one of many, okay? And then the second thing, that sanctuary, me as a citizen of Virginia, those oysters are mine as well as all the other constituents in this state. What makes going through that sanctuary more egregious than going through my private oyster beds? Tell me that. And I've had boats going in there stealing, and we get up close to them, and they're gone, and we can't do anything about it. I've had boats in there that have a letter that gives them a permission. They got the placard on there for working on Coward's ground, and they're in my ground. How can that? What's, why is it more egregious to go through that than it is to go through my oyster beds?
Well, I guess the short answer would be that, like you said, this is everyone's oyster bed, and that's just yours. And also, if anyone was harvesting on your ground, it would be the same felony for dredging on clothes.
I understand, but why is it more egregious to go through that sanctuary than to go through my oyster beds? Tell me that. Why? Come on, tell me. I'm listening.
Well, this is a common resource there. And
well, it belongs to everybody in the state of Virginia, just like my ground. Why is it more egregious?
It shouldn't be. I mean, you mean, why is it more egregious for someone to cross your private ground?
Because why is it more egregious for somebody to go through that sanctuary with a dredge than to go on my oyster bed with a dredge?
You have leased the bottom from the state of Virginia.
That's correct, yes.
And that's why, you know, that's there's long-term agreement that you have freedom of navigation over people's oyster beds.
The legality of taking oysters off of my ground is the same as the legality of getting oysters off that sanctuary.
Right, but the difference is, that's a sanctuary, so going in it is different. The legality is you can get charged with the same larceny of oysters off private as you can in a sanctuary or a closed public ground. So it's very similar. There's just an added layer of protection for the misdemeanor, in part so that harvesters know where they shouldn't be oystering. That's the main reason for having the sanctuary area.
Well, no, I agree that a sanctuary is a good thing for the state.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a wonderful thing.
Well, the private ground might be a different issue that we can address at some point. But
well, the whole point is why is it more critical for going through that than to go through my beds or Ben's beds or Coward's beds or anybody else's?
Well, the state and the Commonwealth has invested everyone's money in that particular area, whereas it's a personal liability for you. And we understand it's egregious that anyone would be stealing oysters from anywhere, but
I think you're going around the point. It's to me, it's just as big a felony to steal oyster from me as it is to steal off that sanctuary.
Absolutely, and that's how it's regulated.
But see, you got more rules for going through the sanctuary than you have for coming through me. You want to do a better job of protection for the sanctuary than you want to do for me. I don't understand that. And it's your job, the state of Virginia's job, to protect me just as much as everybody else. Isn't it?
It's the state of Virginia's job, yeah.
Right.
I mean, I think that's an issue that could be addressed in terms of...
Well, I think it's important. I think it's very important because I think you're just missing the point. You know, everybody is... You're sitting over... You've got a few crooks that would do something bad out there, and it's going to jeopardize 80 or 100 different people because of that. I can't believe that would be your objective.
Having the sanctuary will jeopardize?
No. You have a rule where people can't go through there with a boat if they got a dredge on it.
That's wrong.
You know, it's just... And I was out in the river and that blow the other day, and I ran with the wind for about 3-4 miles so I could come back across because it was so rough, and I knew it was dangerous if I just tried to come straight to where I wanted to be. Didn't have anything to do with the sanctuary, but if I was up there in rescue and I was coming through, it would have been a smart thing for me to go through that. Now, I didn't have a dredge or anything on the boat, but regardless of that, if I did have one, I'd have a problem.
Well, I could potentially see a way forward here.
Well, I think you can see a way forward because... everybody deserves to have the protection of the law, not just for the sanctuary, but for everybody's ground. And that's, you just can't look at it in just one thing. Everybody deserves to have the protection of the law in the state of Virginia, period.
Well, and we need to have some protection, too, that the data is up, is current and up to date, that the sanctuary is in the right place. I'm all for sanctuaries, and I think that they're necessary. But we're operating with old data here, and I think it ought to be looked at.
Are you talking about larva modeling data?
Yes.
You can take most of the larva modeling that exists, and you can put in the parameters that existed that year, and you can't predict exactly what happened. It's sort of a loose model that exists. And running a new model is very expensive, but you can sort of see the numbers speak for themselves in terms of the James River is working well with this sanctuary where it is. And it's sort of hard to, you know, it's...
If it were in some other place, maybe it would work better.
And it's pure speculation that the sanctuary, no one knows what percent of benefit comes from that sanctuary towards those numbers. None of that is proven. It's all speculation.
I think that's almost an impossible answer to give.
I agree it is. And to assume otherwise is inappropriate.
I think you...
And last year I made the motion on this committee when we were looking to reduce effort in the hand scrape fishery to open wreck shoals to hand tonguing only and have those people who decided to participate in that fishery be excluded from the hand scrape fishery for that season. Not forever, not anything else, just if you did one, you couldn't do the other to help reduce the effort but not put people out of work. And at that point, Dr. Weston told me that there was no reason to do that because there weren't enough oysters on Rack Shoals to make any difference.
I can't speak onto what was said.
I'm just saying, and now we're worried about who can travel across there and what short period of time can they steal because there's 17 bushels caught in 15 minutes or whatever that number was you mentioned at the beginning. So what facts are we working with? We need... If we're making decisions, we need to work with facts, not speculation or opinion or the...
The man that caught the 17 bushels is the one that ought to be caught. Not put these people's... you know, I've got friends and relatives that are operating in Carolina skiffs and dead rise work boats, too. And they don't need to have their lives put in jeopardy on an assumption that that sanctuary is in the right place across the mouth of that harbor. And in addition to that, we don't have current data to justify where it's placed.
We have current data in terms of the number of oysters there, the number of shell on the bottom, the substrate compared to the harvest areas, the hand tong areas. I mean, that's
and when James River was in its prime, that piece of ground was open just the same as all the rest of it.
And that analytical data is very, very good, but I'm going to tell you something now, and Jim would tell you this if he was here, but they opened up a section over there at Day's Point one time to let people harvest over there, and the amount of oysters that got caught over there surpassed Jim's analytical data about threefold, okay? What he was talking about just a minute ago, if they had allowed some tongers to go in there and work, look at the analytical data that you would have got from that to support the existence of that. But believe me, I'm not condemning the existence of that sanctuary. I think it's a wonderful thing because you need to have oysters to spawn. So I'm not averse to that either.
What I'm saying is we don't have the information to put people's lives in jeopardy when they just simply sail across it, you know, with the gear on board. It's just that troubles me.
The majority of the areas that you'd have to cross are either private ground or they're hand tong areas. So that's one thing. So most people with a hand scrape on board wouldn't be crossing those areas.
No, but if you're hand tonging and have the oysters on the boat, then you are in violation.
I thought the hand tong, you couldn't cross with a hand tong if you had oysters.
Without oysters on board, you can cross.
Well,
you know, there you go. Button. First of all, I want to thank you for your first SBAC meeting right here. Hope you enjoy it. I'm all for the sanctuary. But the safety issue is a big thing. I do a Carolina skiff. It's a big thing. But those few bad apples that are poaching that, you'll never catch them. Mm-hmm. They're smart. They can work for NASA as rocket scientists. I mean, they're smart. So for the rest of them to suffer for safety issues, because if I was a Carolina skiff and the weather was bad, I'm going to cut through that. I can tell you that right now. I agree with what you're saying. You're never going to catch the bad guy. So I think we're just making it harder on a bunch of other people and making it, you know, and the people that are getting tickets are the guys who aren't doing right. And some of them, you know, are just is in a bad situation. They're just trying to cut through. So them bad apples, it's just we're trying to make it hard on everybody for a few bad apples. I mean, just the other day, for me, myself, as somebody had a, SOS called me. They were breaking down. I got in my boat with a drudge on, went out there. I didn't even think about it. Well, I broke every law in the book, but I was just trying to help somebody out. I was in there with, you know, khaki pants and polo shirt, and I just went on out there and saved, you know, helped tow the guy in, but I didn't even think about my drudge. So in situations, that's probably going to be the discretion of the officer. We got to, you know, take that into consideration. But I don't think punishing everybody for a few. And you're never going to catch those bad apples. You're never going
to
get them.
I can't speak to what law enforcement would do in a certain situation, but they do have discretion if there was a danger of life or property in terms of a boat. You know, it's every mariner's responsibility to take those two things into account before anything else.
That's correct.
You need to put some more markers out there. If you're going to keep that thing in place, you need to put have it adequately marked, and it's not adequately marked now.
Where are the poles now? I haven't been there in forever.
They're just on those two, the two northern sides right there. The other ones are distinguished by the channel markers.
The two upriver?
Yeah.
On the upper river end, they're 1.7 miles away from
right,
each other.
Right here. Though that's only about a mile across.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah, right there. A lot less than that, actually, about three quarters of a mile.
And the one up above that, get your lighter on there.
That one there.
There. There's a pole there. And a pole there.
Yeah.
All right, go across the river.
Those are marked by channel markers. Yeah, those are red.
There's a lot of channel markers. You don't know which one.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
How far is that line?
It's rough.
From the top one to the channel marker.
What, right here?
No.
This one?
From there to there.
A little more than a mile and a half. There's one with a scale.
There's no way you can see that line from there.
Are they bell buoys or
floaters?
They're full-size channel buoys designed for naval ships. You can see them from a good ways off.
It always will. I've got an audio in there.
Yeah.
Is there a specific concentration in that area, or is it oysters in the entire area?
In terms of wreck shoals or that?
Wreck shoals.
Most of the area is pretty solid oyster bottom. I mean,
what percentage has oysters?
I couldn't give you a number that I'm comfortable with in terms of the actual percentage, but I would say more than half of the bottom is probably
50%. Mm-hmm. How many people have you gotten wrote tickets of oyster on that?
I don't have those numbers for you.
Could we get some comment from the law enforcement guys? Do you guys do the James?
Yes.
You might get a couple of years. 2016, we had four. So it's not a big thing. But I tell you, we get a lot of complaints on the guys, and I know all y'all know that hang right there on that edge.
And, old gate there?
We work a lot of those complaints, but like he said, it's very, very difficult.
It's the same ones all
long ways.
The same ones all the time. Same guys all the time.
Are these guys notorious?
Some are.
So the notorious guys are having an effect on the people that aren't notorious.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
A lot of our complaints come from board.
Sure.
You know,
well, that's... Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
But not all of them are working the sanctuary. I mean, you can be a good oysterman and have
how many
it
you mapped got
out
in
your GPS and know where you're supposed to be and work that line hard and work it legally. I mean, that's doable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, watermen can get upset if people are doing right and catching a lot or doing wrong and catching a lot.
Absolutely.
So there are people that are doing it right.
Sure.
Okay. It's not all of them that are working the line that are outlaws.
No.
Well, all of them don't have GPS either.
Yeah. Well, then they should be more cautious, in my opinion. They should be overly cautious and stay further away if they don't have a way of knowing where they're supposed to be.
Well, does that apply to sailing, too?
What do you mean sailing?
I mean sailing across it.
Well, I support letting people go across. I think that's wrong from a safety standpoint.
So you need more buoys on that. They've got to be closer together, whether they're floaters or whatever. You can't see a mile and a half. You can't see a mile. I've got gill nets out there that are 200 fathoms long. I have to take binoculars to see them. Miles, long ways on the water.
Well,
seems reasonable there. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to add one thing to that. I was at a meeting over here a number of years ago, and what the regulation was for the markers was they can't be no closer than 200 feet apart, I believe is what it was. So your corners have to be marked, or the areas within the confines of where you're working would have to be marked. And the reason I was complaining about it, because I had my poles closer together than that. And the people at the commission said, there's no problem, Mr. DeMaria. We're glad for you to have your poles closer together. So they didn't have a problem with that. But the law says they can't be no closer to 200 unless it's changed.
It's
150. No closer than 150?
So
you could have just the corners marked, and you'd be perfectly legal, which is what the sanctuary's marked. Is that right, Ben?
150 feet, Ben.
The minimum distance is 150 feet.
Okay.
I can certainly approve a modification of that in certain circumstances where you might need to do it. If you're working aquaculture-type activity inside your lease, you can mark that area separately with four corners or more.
Okay.
And we understand lots of times in that instance, the stakes might have to be closer than 150 feet. If you're doing a small area, then you want to put three or four or five stakes to mark it off.
But to address what he just said, you know, it would be perfectly fine to have the markers 500 yards apart. There's,
I mean, for the sanctuary, I don't want to get in the middle of it because this is his program.
Come on.
Well, I mean,
we could put more markers on the sanctuary so that my feeling for private ground is you need three stakes per line to know you're not crossing the line.
Okay, I agree.
Turn around and look behind.
So you have a range, range mark.
Right.
Absolutely.
Visually, you know, but a long way.
So I just wanted to make sure everybody on the board understands that, because there's no law that says you have to have them 150. They can't be no closer than 150. That's what I want to make sure everybody understands.
The regulation for private ground says no closer than 150.
Good.
I can approve as chief engineer some alternates to that if needed,
What are the markers, the two markers that are on there now? What are they? What are these
they're,
giant
they're
poles?
Pilings with no harvest.
And how tall are they?
They're at least 6 foot above mean low water for that range.
How far do you have to be away from them to see them on a typical day?
It's 1.7 miles apart.
Excuse me?
They're 1.7 miles apart.
No, I'm just saying, how far do you have to be away from one to see it?
Well, I go by there. I can see them all the time. But when you're in between two of them, they're 1.7 miles apart.
Yeah.
How do you know you're in this line right here or 50 feet over that way?
I don't know. So what I'm getting at is how far apart?
Be able to see them.
On the weather.
Yeah. I don't probably.
Some days you can't see too far. Other days you can.
I'll always show up on.
I would think, at least 100 yards or 200 yards or something like that. I would think. But the other thing, too, that you need to have in the back of your mind, and this goes back a right good while ago, and there used to be some ground over there close to Jail Island where the state had put these floating buoys up over there where you could work within the confines of those floating buoys and you were legal, but if you got outside of that, you would get a ticket. Well, the guys would just take their boat and tie that buoy and tow it wherever the hell they wanted to tow it. You know, so I'm just bringing that to your attention because it's a major job to put them poles down like they got over there right now. Those are creosote pylons, like telephone poles, like you see on the side of the road, you know. And you're just putting a floating buoy over there that could be just towed anytime you feel like
it. That's part of the issue with the sanctuaries that we have now is we're not a buoy-tending fleet. You know, we don't drive pilings. Any sort of permanent markers that we do a minimum because we're not in the business of maintaining private aids navigation. But we do try to mark areas with our buoys, which can be moved.
Well, I understand that. I had a boat working on my ground over Squash's Hole one time, and the guys on the boat called and said they were being VMRC had come to them and were questioning whether they were legal or not. And they called me up, and I called up Rob Butler over here. And the MPO gave Rob Butler the GPS readings inside my ground, and they were 300 yards inside my ground. So I said, yeah, that's perfectly fine. They're where they're supposed to be. So it's no problem. But the point being is these guys, when they see a boat that's over there, they get a reading on where he's at, a GPS reading, and they can use that to verify whether or not he's within the confines of that area. Isn't that correct? So that's how all that works. But I assume you know that as well. But
I guess I'll go ahead.
Could you look into seeing what it would take or cost to put two additional poles on the upriver line, the one on the other side of the river, and the one pointing towards Newport News, and then one additional one between the area where there's already two poles. So that would be an additional
two here,
one there, two there, and two on the other side.
On the channel where it's at?
Yeah, so it would be a total of seven additional markers.
Yeah, I'd probably be smart to do that.
That's one of the biggest complaints I hear from my friends that are working in the James is we can't see the freaking line.
Probably permanent, I don't know, just messing here based on previous costs, probably about $7,000 or something like that. But
and that would be good. That's very smart to protect the sanctuary, but it still doesn't address the issue of the boat going through there.
Well, that's another issue. Let's just do one thing at a time.
The one thing at a time right now is the boats getting tickets going through there. That's
okay. Well, I was going to do something about that next, but I'd at least like to get that on the books to see what it take. I mean, $7,000 out of our – how much do we get a year? $2 million?
That's the replenishment.
Okay, well, I think that's a justifiable expense for our replenishment program.
That's law enforcement, they confirmed, because I thought I remembered it. But when we originally set this up and we put the pilings in, we did set three along that western boundary, or two, with the buoy at the southern end.
Yep.
And we set one in the middle.
Yep.
And we set one in the north. But the middle one came out. I don't think it ever got
set. Okay, well.
Because we knew that line was important.
That's part of the cost of doing business with our replenishment program. I know we're not in the business of
pole
maintenance, but if we're going to have a sanctuary,
is anybody here on staff familiar with the regulations that the scallop industry has, where they have to do something to their gear to make it where they can't use it for going until they get to the ground that they're going to go to?
I'm not very familiar.
I mean, what they do is they have to have the dredge disconnected from the tow line, and I mean, that would be something that could be done that would make it virtually you're unable to use the dredge because it's not able to be put in and out of the water quickly and discreetly.
I mean, potentially. I mean, that's your prerogative is to make advise the commission there. So, you know, we got extra poles there. We can take this in the form of, you know, if you want to make suggestions for how to address with that and go forward from there, and we can move on to.
And what are you looking to us to recommend with regard to traveling through the sanctuary?
Well,
a recommendation or
support it or no support it?
Well, basically, yeah. Whether or not. You can do a yes or no, either to support it or you can make a recommendation, sort of address the issue regulatorily. I mean, the issue on the table is a change in code. This is what it was going to potentially read. This is what got tabled right there. But VMRC doesn't have any control over this directly. This is the legislator right here.
Okay.
So we could address this regulatory through our stuff and potentially not have this change in the code section. So this is how it was proposed as a change there.
Was the request of the Chesapeake Subcommittee for VMRC just to take it up, or are we supposed to, as is an answer, supposed to go back to the subcommittee?
They'd like an answer, sort of recommendation, sort of us to have addressed this issue and basically come up with a some sort of either yes, no, or we can do this instead.
See, somebody back here in the back wants to add some.
Go ahead.
Okay. Nice to y'all know me. I'm Lisa Rose from the Porsche Board and Oystering. I have a few comments I'd like to make. I was there at the Virginia General Assembly this year about this House bill that the subcommittee asked to take it back to this committee and have you all figure out about the going across sanctuary and to resolve it here. If not, they will take care of it next January and General Assembly. And it had a lot to do with Jonathan Summers. Of course, last Wednesday his case was dropped. He was doing a public service event at the Tides Inn in Irvington. And Jody Carter and the general manager of the Tides Inn having their big taste of the bay and said, hey, we'd love to have our dogs filled with watermen. Jonathan Summers said, no problem. Put his khaki pants on, Sperry's on, jumped in the boat, went, had a field day. I mean, that brings in a lot of attention from Virginia Tourism, for the seafood community. They love oysters. Had a good day going back and he was stopped. That Saturday afternoon, his dredge was dry. The charter showed exactly where he was going. He got a ticket, got his dredge taken away and his GPS. On Monday morning, went down to the dock at Mosquito Point, charged him with a felony and took him to jail. So we had to go to court, and then the felony was dropped, wanting him to plead to a misdemeanor, and it was suggested by VMRC that he's a troublemaker and that they wanted to create a history on him. And so his lawyer said, absolutely not, we'll go to trial. And so we went up there, got all dressed up, went to court, and the common attorney came out and said, charges have been dropped. You're free to go, Officer Brown, we jump the parking lot, leave back your stuff. This is why we're fighting for the sanctuary. Like you said, there's 2%. How many people? John Bull said in the meeting last year there were 61 people, and the 3 years that he has been here that have been having their license taken away. And there's 908 oyster user licenses that are out there. That's a very minimal percentage, and half of those aren't even from oyster violations out of that 61. Why can't they go across if there's bad weather? Or what? The last thing on our mind is, we're going to steal. Number one, this is saying, implying to me as a taxpayer, a mother, a waterman, that you're calling me a thief. And I really do not appreciate that, because that's what this law is implying, that I am tempted to steal those oysters. I'm not tempted to steal anything. I'm tempted to go to work and make sure that my product is pristine to when I deliver it to my buyer over there. You need to change the sanctuaries. Some of the guys said that if they are working in the James, which I have not, that you have to go buy a special permit from Rescue or the County of Suffolk. So when you're here buying your oyster license, then you have to drive all the way across the James River to go to that county and able to go across that sanctuary. Is that right?
No, not exactly.
No.
Okay.
There's a James River Seabird, and we did address the issues there that we had with that by changing the maps there in the sanctuary to clarify it. So.
We have a special permit for those of us that do good, have a very good sticker or something that, you know, we're not the thieves here. Why can't we pay an extra $10 to have a yellow flag or an orange flag on our boat of some sort to go, we're the good guys, why can't we go through the sanctuary? And according to your little markers thing, I've been out there on Broad Creek and Rappahannock on Area 1. One day, VMRC came hauling ass at us because we were apparently 100 feet off of the buoy marker, and we were yelled at, not talked to, yelled at, to get off of the 100 feet away from the buoy marker. Well, I'm a drafting design degree. I studied Da Vinci. It's a little hard to, you know, to judge the difference between a buoy and when you're on a moving boat 100 feet. So are you supposed to be 100, if you're supposed to be 100 feet off that marker, then move the buoy to that 100 feet off of that marker. Don't expect the waterman to judge distance, because everybody judges, you know, 6 inches or 3 inches a different way, unless you have the call stick in hand too. So, and then the next day we had another guy come over and board us for a different reason while we were working, and he said, no, that was to the officer's discretion as well. So, you know, there's no consistency there. And it needs to be balanced, and there needs to be consistency. There is.
I agree that consistency is something to go for there, but I'm not a law enforcement officer, so I can't speak to that, but go ahead.
So the legislature sent that, tabled the legislation.
That's correct.
And sent it to us to act on. Okay, then I'd like to make a motion based on what John said with regard to boats with dredge gear, that the dredge be disconnected and that they fly a there's a day mark, I mean a day shape
meeting
that commercial fishing boats are required to fly by the Coast Guard, that be suspended from their mast, boom, or something indicating that their dredge is disconnected and that they're traveling through the sanctuary.
So like a fishing day shape or something?
Yep,
like,
yep.
That
it looks like an hourglass.
Yep.
That's when you're restricted in your
or basket. Everybody's got baskets on their boat.
You can also use a basket. The
trawl
boat can also
green
fly
basket
a basket
or whatever.
So either or, and that the people be allowed.
I would say if you have a full load of oysters and you're going across due to hazardous weather conditions and you fly a day shape, saying that you're restricted in your ability to maneuver, that should cover you without any change.
Well, you can be restricted to your ability to move, or just out of something else problem that you have on the boat. It doesn't have to be weather related.
I don't go along with that, because you're going to find somebody that says it's not restricted, and it is restricted. You either got to do it or you don't.
I mean, what I'm proposing is that they be allowed to go through the sanctuary, dredge untied, fly that basket or commercial fishing day shape, and they can go through the sanctuary. And tongers as well. That's my suggestion, recommendation, motion.
Do you want to make that as a motion?
I did.
Okay. I don't agree with it.
I think we ought to just make a straight up motion where you go through it. It's, to me, if it had to be that way, I would be all for it. But I don't see any reason why I can't go through that sanctuary anytime I want to.
I agree.
I don't. People go through my oyster ground anytime they want to.
Regardless of
I think they ought to adequately market and be able to sail across that ground anytime you want to.
Well, yeah, but I think having it marked properly would allow MPOs to be able to do their job more effectively, because you'll be able to see. You know, it's just hard to look at two points that are 1.7 miles apart and be able to figure it out.
You ought to be able to sail across the water any way you want to.
Yeah, I agree.
And regardless of what it is, what shape you're flying, what you're doing, if someone is there to enforce the infraction of you traveling through the sanctuary, they're there to enforce the infraction of you working in the sanctuary.
And that's critical,
so
right there, what you just said.
If the eyes are on you, then let you travel where you want to travel, and those eyes that are on you catch you when you're doing wrong and leave the rest of everybody alone.
Well,
and
I agree with you.
That can't be done in regulation, but that's a...
What do you mean it can't? Let them travel. It just take. I mean...
Well, in terms of you can't regulate that there has to be enforcement out there. But.
Well, it's... I mean, that's the charge of VMRC to maintain...
For all the modern technology we got now with the radar and GPS overlay, can't you spot a boat in an area and see exactly where it's at, the coordinates with that?
Yes, you got to have.
And it just won't hold up in court.
Well, you got to have it. What do you have to have it? Have it? Have it tested at the accuracy of it at that point in time.
To be able to testify to your data off your machine,
right?
You'd have to have it. I don't know the terminology.
If it's close,
have to be certified at the time it was recorded.
I understand if it was close to the line, but if it wasn't close, what? If it was in a regular ways, it still wouldn't hold up?
Nope.
No. The golden rule with us is you've got to be able to pinpoint, like he was telling, if we are lucky enough to get to them, we mark that spot, call it in, and that's how we verify.
GPS
it. Out, make it to court, show the judge, this is exactly where we were when we were.
Exact. That's it.
You don't have a chance.
Can I ask a question?
Very difficult.
How many, let me ask a question, how many were dropped? How many were thrown out of court?
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know. I think I'm four of last year.
But they were all convicted?
I don't.
You don't know that?
You know, there's something I don't understand. They caught Marauders on the eastern shore of the Pocomoke Sound. Caught them red-handed. They admitted that they're in Virginia. One of them just got out of court, 235 hours. He wasn't handcuffed. He wasn't carried to jail. And it's pretty sad when we're carrying our own taxpayers to jail and we'll let a Marylander sail his boat home, spend his night with his family.
Well,
that's hard. It's hard to. And I will say this, if you're in a sanctuary, you're not supposed to be there. If you go to jail, you go to jail. I mean, the writing's on the wall now. Don't blame nobody but yourself if you end up with cuffs on you. But it's just hard to see when you've caught three Marylanders up in the Pocomoke Sound and all three of those Marylanders have been able to go back home.
So I guess we have sort of two separate motions there. We have add seven additional poles and you're allowed to cross the sanctuary there if your dredge is unhooked and incapable of fishing. Is that sort of more or less the gist of your sort of motion there, Tom?
Incapable of pulling the dredge, yeah. And that was based on what John said. I thought
I'd like to modify that motion. Anybody can drive through that sanctuary anytime they want, period.
You want to modify and make a second motion?
Make a second motion?
You want to put that one to a vote?
I can put the first one to a vote there just to have some comparison.
Oh, you need a second first.
Is there a second on Tommy?
I have one question. Technically, does this go from SMAC to the legislator, or does this have to go to the commission to the legislator?
Okay.
We were asked
Oh, I'm sorry.
Provide a report there to the legislator on what the advisory committee's decision was, and if we decide that we can take care of it through regulatory action, that could be a recommendation, or if we go straight to the legislator without that. So it's sort of up to the committee, I would say.
All right, I'm ready to make a motion, and that's on that dark highlighted print on the bottom. It is not unlawful to carry or transport an oyster dredge or oyster dredging equipment through an oyster sanctuary area when the boat is traveling to or from such ground or docks. That's the motion I'd like to make.
Well, that
simply saying we approve the amendment, I think, is what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Approve the amendment.
Why not just have it so that the gear has to be on?
Well, it's
not.
Well, the simplest thing you're doing, it's unshackling.
Yeah, that would go a long way, I think.
Because if you're there, you can put that shackling in fire.
Well, if it had to be that way, we could go that way. I mean, I just don't understand. Like I said before, why is it more egregious for someone to go through that sanctuary than to go through your oyster ground that you got over in Lynn Haven?
I'm not disagreeing with that. I think it would just go a long way, and we stand
well,
a better
sure
chance.
You're right.
I think we stand a better chance of getting this through by requiring that
the
gear be.
Who made the amendment?
I have no clue. But I'm just.
Where did the amendment come from?
Delegate Hassel.
That came from a delegate over in Bacosin.
That's correct. Yeah,
so I'd like to support him.
Go ahead, Tom.
I'd like to offer a substitute motion to John's that the gear would have to be disconnected during transport through the sanctuary.
And I'll second that.
You want to call a vote, I guess?
Yeah. So what is the motion? We're so convoluted on
the motion is we approve.
When it has to be disconnected.
We approve the amendment with the addition of saying the gear has to be disconnected.
And does that include looking into additional poles or?
Additional poles. You can cross the sanctuary. As long as your dredge or any oyster catching gear is incapable of fishing or disconnected.
Okay.
Disconnected, okay. Yeah.
Just plain disconnected.
Just plain disconnected.
Okay. All right, cool. All right. All right.
Second, vote.
It's second.
I guess all in favor?
Aye.
Any noes?
Cool. Well, the people over there at the state of Virginia ought to appreciate a complete backup by the industry.
To put this to rest, I'd also like to make a motion that we refer this to the Chesapeake House Subcommittee as well as to the commission at the same time, so that in the event that we're moving forward, it's moving forward in both directions.
Very good idea.
We could probably get that on the April agenda, or the May agenda, excuse me, for the commission at the same time, submit it there. So,
is that sufficient?
I make a motion.
What?
Is there a second?
Second.
Yeah.
Second.
All in.
Don Porter.
On.
Okay. I'll
see you. Is all in favor there?
Yes.
Aye. Any opposed?
Cool.
Rock and roll.
Kathy, on that first motion,
make an hour.
Make sure you have a no vote.
Yeah,
I voted no. On the first.
I thought you did. I put it down.
Okay, thank you.
It's really on this motion. Well, that one, yeah.
Right.
That disconnecting.
All right, well, moving on from that excitement there. So there's been some talk of overcrowding on Handscrape areas. This isn't to particularly set the mood, but this is just to highlight that this hasn't been, and it's not an old argument in terms of overdredging, overscraping. This is the same thing that's been being said about various oyster ground since the 1880s. So it's a reality that exists that you can overwork the oyster ground. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But the issue that we're addressing is the sort of overcrowding that exists and how to potentially alleviate that. And just for reference there, that's, I believe, either a part of Marshall's or I can't remember if that was from Shell Rock there, Marshall's Rock and the Pocomoke, and this is from our fall Patentong survey of an area that didn't get any shell last year, and this is what the bottom looks like in part of that area. It's just sort of a hash of shell there, and this was a dredge area that's been dredged on pretty heavily there. But
we didn't get any spats out, I do know that.
Mm-hmm.
So, all around it.
So keeping that in mind, these are sort of the options that I just come up with. There's other options. There's sort of pros and cons each one of these. But this isn't something that we have to decide today. This is just something to sort of think about, and we'll probably be back in, you know, August to sort of address the harvest areas and come up with seasons. But we can sort of work through these if you'd like and sort of see what your thoughts are on these points there.
What's that last one, reduce the size of the fishery? How could you possibly do that?
We've pretty well taken
care of that. We've pretty well taken care of that, but that's one
it's
of the...
It's a work in progress,
yeah,
right now.
Yeah.
Through attrition, we're waiting for attrition to take its course.
I mean, these are just options. They're not, you have to do any of these. It's, you know, these are ways to address this issue right there.
That shellfish, the guy that harvests the oyster shells, what's the status with that? Is that...
That's what we can. There's an update there on the replenishment. You know, we can get to that there. But so the first option that we have there is to allow harvester to self-regulate. And when the oystering's good with a hand scrape, most people can finish. You know, when it's good, you know, by 10 o'clock, and the harvest regulations, you go till 2. So if people wanted, in theory, you could leave a little later, come back a little later, and still catch your limit there. It's not always perfect. I understand the weather, but that's basically the do-nothing option in terms of let it stand as it is with the amount of harvest effort in the current areas that we're planning on opening in the year. So that's an option there. And then something that we could look into is in October, a lot of people are still crabbing. If you're a full-time waterman, there's other work to be done. So there's potential that we could open up Handtong areas, maybe an additional Patentong area, and then open up more hand scrape areas simultaneously in November, and that would sort of divide your effort a little bit. There wouldn't potentially be that overcrowding, but the overcrowding issue, I think we can all acknowledge that sometimes if there's rumors that you might catch your limit here quickly, people tend to go there, whether that's true or not. So it's you know, a lot of these issues have been tried before, so, but that's one option. The sort of change in gear type there was, you know, potentially have a hand scrape area start as pat and tong in October and then switch to hand scrape in November just to sort of alleviate some of that crowding, because then in November you could have potentially more areas open up simultaneously. And then what we tried before is open up areas simultaneously. I think we did this in 2006, 2007, and, you know, a lot of people, a lot of areas were fished out by, you know, by December when they were all opened up there in October. And then there's, you know, it's an option that we could look for potentially other hand scrape areas, but there's, you know, you can see it's not, there's not hard science yet behind it, but you can see potentially what happens when you open up areas to new hand scrape areas. We don't have the shell budget to replenish them, that can affect you further down the road in terms of recruitment and our ability to maintain that area once it's been scraped. We only have the shell budget to cover about half the areas right now that need it. So if we do open up additional areas, there's no guarantee that we'd be able to maintain those areas. So it might give you a little bit of a windfall for a year or two, but there's a good chance that that would be it, and then that area would be permanently degraded, and we wouldn't be able to build it back up. So then, you know, reducing the size of the fishery. So those are sort of the options that I'm laying out, and I'm open to new ones, but that's what we got so far. So open it up there to discussion, I guess.
How you feel about closing it in October, Tommy?
You know, my same argument as it always will. We're going to, you know, we're going to be last to come on the market if we do that. I mean, Mississippi, Maryland, everyone else is going to be in the market. And, you know, where it creates an issue for someone like myself being self-serving is I've got to continue to operate, and everyone knows we need, you know, we've wiped out all the private oysters by October. You know, it's hard for me to commit to someone in October and then cut them off in November and say, sorry, I got... It just personally, it's something that we've never done. When we make a commitment, whether it's that, I mean, a lot of you guys have sold us, you know, when we buy, we never say we're not buying. We do what we got to do to buy. And I just have a problem going somewhere else in October for resource and then telling them the first day of November, sorry, I'm done.
Wouldn't this be true of most all the packers?
Yeah, I mean, all that I know of and deal with are pretty respectable people when they... When they make a commitment, they live by it. So
no, I'm talking about the impact that you're talking about.
Yeah, you don't want to lose your customers. You got a customer, and you lose them to Maryland or someone else, then it's hard to get them back. Because they've got somebody else that they justified switching to.
You know, RSU here in Virginia, we are one of the few states that shucks through the summer, which in a lot of cases doesn't make sense. But the frustrating thing is, in particularly now with Maryland, they come online in October. Cut prices and get in the market. They've had the luxury of not losing money on poor oysters for 2 months prior, so they jump right in. And I could see it being a little worse situation if we didn't have access to some resource in October. And I'm worried about the oystermen. I mean, we've got a large population of bay watermen now that are year-round oystermen. And what we see is by October, you know, the private is exhausted. And, you know, that's why you see a lot of people going to these areas, is because they need work and somewhere to go. As far as the guys that are able to still make it crabbing, that actually helps the situation in my mind, that they've got something else to do and aren't dependent on this resource. But to answer your question, I would be concerned about not having something other than a little bit of hand tong area open in October.
Well, there could be additional pat tong areas or maybe a limited scrape areas open.
Well, the Rappahannock.
You do a combination area there. Yep.
The Rappahannock's the biggest problem. Everybody hits that in October. Nothing else open. We need to open up something else in October. I mean, you and I were talking on the phone. You could open up 9 and 10 home and keep most Eastern Shoremen out of the Rappahannock. Now, how many of that is, I don't know. But
we can open up some pat and tong. Mm-hmm. And then do that, maybe do that in some areas that we hand scrape at. Do pat and tong at first, and that would limit the resource, but give us, like me and Tommy, like I agree with Tommy, our saving grace is having product year-round. Mm-hmm. And when Maryland comes online, oh brother, oh my. And they just, I don't think they make money. I think they just work to produce oysters.
But they don't want to lose their business.
And they don't want to lose the business. Yeah. But like Tommy says, we've been struggling and shucking poor oysters just to keep our customers going. So, you know, in October, that's our saving grace. And that's what the customers look at later on. Well, you know, oh, this oyster house sold me oysters 52 weeks out of the year. That's what keeps us ahead of the rest of the game. So
that was my question. That's the sentiment of most all the Virginia Packers, what you're saying.
Yes. Okay. I mean,
so it doesn't sound like closing October.
The Patentong did help. I mean, the area in Deep Rock this year, I mean, there were a number of boats that stayed out of York River or James River. One of them's in here that, you know, worked that area, and that is effective in having another area and gear type to keep effort out of some of these other rivers, because all of those guys that were in that Deep Rock Patentong area December through February would have had to have gone to one of the HS areas that were open. So it is an effective way to kind of move things around.
There could be a combination. This is just a proposed one there. This has, you know, a Patentong area open and then all Hantong in October, and then, you know, Handscrape comes online in two areas simultaneously there in November, so that's already split between the James and the Rappahannock. And then Patentong area there coming on, so someone could rig up for Patentong and you can stay going the whole year, you know, not have to change rigs there as an option. And that's a more efficient gear than, you know, Hantong's, obviously. So this is a option there, and, you know, we could, there's other ways that we could skin this cat, so to speak, but, you know, there's downsides and upsides to everyone, so we don't have to do just one of those. But I'm hearing that potentially open up some Patentong areas in October and or have more than one Handscrape area open would be sort of preferable options. Is that?
Is 9 and 10, I can't see from here. Is 9 and 10 proposed to be open?
Area 9 is Hantong. Yeah.
Across the bay.
Pocomo. I haven't got to that yet. I mean, you can sort of see that area isn't doing well right now in terms of, well, you've seen for yourself recruitment there. And stat fall has consistently gone down since areas 9 and 10 have been open. I'm not saying that we can scientifically prove that the SPAT came from there. That's very hard to do regardless of the model you use, but you can see a strong correlation between opening up those areas to Handscrape and, you know, the recent SPAT fall there. I would be more willing to do that if there was sort of a commitment to do some replenishment activity following that to any new Handscrape area that we opened up. Sort of make a preemptive commitment to go back, shell that area, potentially even do, you know, some sort of alternative substrate if there is federal money outside of the harvest area, as, you know, you could call it a no-harvest area but not on public ground if that's an option. But I would be hesitant just to open up a new scrape area without putting anything back.
But how about spreading some of the Handscrape area in the James River out? One of those in October.
There's, you could sort of divide current harvest areas into more than one area and stagger their opening like that to split the fleet. And, you know, right now the lower James River, Nansman Ridge, Upper Thomas's, they've had, you know, there's still a lot of small oysters right there. So I think it could support, you know, potentially a staggered opening there. You know, you might end up with a whole bunch of boats there condensed on a smaller area and end up damaging some shell source there just by, you know, the pure density if you did do that. So there's sort of, if everyone goes there because the Rappahannock's not good and you get that same chunk in a smaller area, that's a potential downfall to doing that. But, you know, it's hard to predict where 908 watermen are going to go opening day in October. So
how many boats was in the Rappahannock last year? Do you know?
I would say as many as 110 to 15, and towards the end, probably 60 to 80. It's one consideration. The chart that we look at on the James, I completely agree, the James is a workhorse, but, you know, it's not exactly apples to apples when you take into consideration that you've got areas in the Rappahannock that are open 32 days out of 1,003 days, and you've boxed in smaller areas as opposed to a river that you open up for 3 months, go anywhere.
This is private, public. This is everything.
I understand, but my point is, if some, like the Rappahannock, if it were open to the effect that the James is for the period of time the James is open, it would be a larger percentage of that number than what it is. So I just make the point that the Rappahannock would be a bigger producer if it were open a bigger window than what it is, in the same fashion that you know in the Rappahannock we've got 6 harvest areas. So it, and like I say, they're open the last 2 years, which we all fought beginning, but it seemed to work pretty well. The Fridays off, so you're basically working 16 days out of a month with 2 months to the area. That's where I'm coming up with my 32 days, 3-year rotation. So you're, you know, in excess of 1,000 days. So basically, Area 4, which is I'm sure the mandatory reporting numbers, if they come back, that was a huge harvest in there this year. Point being that that's open 32 days out of 1,000 and whatever. So you're not exactly comparing apples to apples when you compare a river that all the areas are open for 3 months and just go where you want. It's a different matrix to that number. But don't take that as I'm saying that James River isn't doing a tremendous job and continuing to produce. But
I mostly, trying to stress that this is an important, you know, resource. Yeah, absolutely, you can't compare a creek to a creek practically there in terms of what you're going to get out of it. So.
The problem with us in the industry is, and I'm timing my grade, is we seem to get everything at one time, and then in December we're struggling trying to find out what we're going to do. You know, and then like Tommy says, we make it happen. We buy horses. We won't tell anybody not to work, but it seems like we get all or nothing. And then when December comes around, when, you know, we need more horses on the market.
Well, that's sort of the reality of the efficiency of the hand scrape is you can catch the oysters so quickly when there are so few of them that unless you get oyster populations on all those areas up to where you can use a less efficient gear or, you know, still use a hand scrape but have that population there, which is hard to do if you're continuously scraping and only shelling half the areas that you need. So until you get to that certain point, as long as you continue hand scraping, you're going to have that rush in the beginning as soon as those areas open, and then you can't catch them twice. So,
and to that point, I would want the waterman's opinion. I'm not one to make a decision on this, but, you know, on the 24 bushel versus 16 bushel, it seems, you know, you get all the 24s for the first 2 weeks of the season, and then everybody's struggling to make a limit at the end. To Richie's point, kind of spreading this thing out, just, you know, I don't know the economics from a waterman side, but does it make more sense to, you know, do the 16 the whole time as opposed to doing 24 for 2 weeks? I do question that, trying to spread this out a little bit. And
That would definitely be a discussion
about two men aboard of a boat instead of three.
A lot of people say
you're going to have more boats on the rock, but I don't think so. I think a lot of these third men, for people to just grab until the gravy's there, and then when the gravy's over, they're gone. I mean, I don't know how Dan feels about this or not, if he's still on.
You still there, Dan?
He hit that riddle on the head.
Yeah, he did.
Well, that's
not saying everybody, but there's enough of them.
That's a, you know, all options are sort of on the table. It's only, you know, it's still early. We got till October to, so this is just sort of something to take home and think about. And, you know, sort of like going forward on that. It seems like some kind of combination of this would work to potentially, you know, we don't have to do all of these, but, you know.
Well, coming in new, I appreciate you addressing it and thinking out of the box. And I mean, now is the time to start the conversation and address it, because it's obviously been a huge problem. And it, I mean, every season we see two or three accidents that these guys have to deal with, of someone running in. And I mean, when you take a look at it, it's easy to see how it happens. It's no one's fault. It's work, and it's what happens when you're in that situation.
Yeah, I agree. I see some stuff up there that I never saw before. Some other options. So.
That's all you mean. You're just going to have to figure out soaking it up something else in October along with Rappahannock. Because that's the biggest problem, what I see right now, is all the boats in Rappahannock. If you just spread them out somewhere, somehow, some way.
Well, how do you feel about, you know, some of these areas that are open, there's no rotation area right now, and it's just one area, sort of about dividing them up, and, you know, potentially you could, I know the Rappahannock and the other rotation areas have been somewhat controversial, but if you get, I'm not saying this year, if you get a good population going, it might be beneficial to give them a rest for maybe just 1 year, if you can still have, you know, solid continuous production coming out. But splitting them up this year and sort of staggering them might be a way of sort of introducing that gradually to the area, and seeing how it works, just having one area open instead of, I'm hesitant to make any major changes because in general it's sort of, we're trending in the right direction now, so I sort of want to proceed cautiously here, but just sort of ask your opinion on, you know, potentially this option in October, having one of those areas open up and then staggering it like you do in the Rappahannock with another area.
But if you open some of these hand scrape to patent tong, I mean, there's a limit on the patent tong license. It's not going to be 150 some boats out there. It's going to be, what is it, patent tong? It's 50, 40, something like that.
I think there's a lot more licenses bought, but in terms of actually boats that are rigged up, I think that's about right.
Would you put some type of restriction on that license if you did that?
What, in terms of?
Like if you had a patent tong area opened up first in October, is that going to be a free-for-all? Well, we're going to put some type of restriction on that.
I think the gear type and the skill set and sort of the rig that you need would be sort of self-limiting on
it
that.
It would be,
sort of,
yes.
My opinion on that, but
I didn't know if that was an idea you were thinking about.
In terms of limiting the number of people that could get into patent tonging?
Yes, sir.
I would be hesitant to. I think that would, you know, if it ended up being a problem, but I don't think it would be, just in terms of the amount of people who could rig up and go patent tong in October, so.
You're not going to do that in Carolina Skiff, that's for sure.
No.
So, that'll take care of itself.
And that would, you know, there's Virginia product coming in at a good rate there at that point, and you don't have that influx, and then people who are still crabbing can still crab and then rig up for hand scrape, so that's an option there.
The shells that you put in the, on Shell Rock, they came from a different place.
Those were some of the first shells that came off of right there by Newport News Shipyards from the new site we started.
So where you're getting them all now?
Yeah, most of the area on the Tribal Shoals upriver, most of those areas have been.
Did you plant them anywhere else besides Shell Rock?
Yeah, no.
Now, how are they doing? The other places, have they got a spat set on them? Or?
More than Shell Rock has, yeah.
Shell Rock concerns me because I think Merlin has gotten their oyster rocks they have tore them up from October 1st till March, year after year. I think that's where we're getting a lot of our spat set on Shell Rock, the way the tidal flow goes through there. I'm hoping I'm wrong because, I mean, they have, it's nothing there. I mean, they save stuff that big because of the box market. The guy was getting them, I think, $80 a bushel. As long as it was 400 plus.
Yeah.
So.
Aquaculture oysters.
That's the scary part. The box market's where the money's at, but I think it might be what's going to kill us too before it's over.
Yeah. And you know,
I think this is from one of the areas of Shell Rock that didn't get shell. there are marshals.
But there's a couple places there that we do have some small oysters. I mean, you got to look for them. I mean, everybody's looking for something 2.5, 2.75, but if you look, you'll see those 1 inches in there. There's quite a few have seen them once we started looking for them. But those shells you planted, they just didn't strike. I mean, that's what concerned me. I didn't know if the same shell struck somewhere else. If it did, then it's not a problem.
It seemed generally the fossil shell holds up, gets as much strike as house shell if you compare it year to year on a large scale, sort of on a controlled point. You know, if you put it in a setting tank, it's different. But, you know.
Now, you said something about shelling 9 and 10. How would you do that? What boat?
Not carefully.
Not those barges and tugs. Mm-hmm. They do more damage up there than, I mean, you got any home with root? I mean, a jury?
Yeah, probably smaller boats would have to be.
It'd have to be. Yeah. You only got about 7 foot of water there. Mm-hmm. 8 foot at the max on high water. But go ahead, that's getting off subject. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to stay on the subject a minute, Don.
Oh, go ahead, Dan. Well.
this thing Gary got going on this summer, planted shells back on Cod Harbor. Can't they go somewhere to poke them open? I mean, if I had to poke them open in shells in some places, you know, can't they go shell rock or down there to Science Pit or some, you know, somewhere up there, even up on areas 9 and 10?
Yeah.
I mean, Cod Harbor ain't been open in years. It does very little. I mean, it's a very small rock anyway, and in about 10 or 15 years at the most, Santa Beach is going to be right on top of it. I mean, this just looks like to me it's going to be money wasted. Why? You know, I understand that they were planted off on the mud, that some of the tugs didn't put them just right. Why not take them up and put them somewhere to some use? Instead of putting them down here to Cod Harbor, keep them over there somewhere, Allen Rock. We'll plant them somewhere rather than down here in Cod Harbor where nobody's going to do anything with them.
I guess the main reason for putting them there is recruitment's been down a little bit there over your way. And, you know, it's a lot bigger areas and it's held up pretty good, but basically using that as a potential little area where there's some brute stock coming from, because, I mean, you saw how hard Thoroughfare in California got worked this year. Is if there's not oysters close to each other, you guys might end up having a similar problem that the rest of the Pocomoke seen, if there's not sort of that little deposit there in Cod Harbor of, oysters that are close enough together to get spawn going. So that was the reason for that. But I think, you know, I'd potentially be open if Jerry's still catching some shell there. Once we've sort of put some on that area, we're flexible as to where those can go. So, area 9 and 10 potentially would be an option for that. But, I'm hesitant to commit to that area until we sort of have a plan for what to do with it. So that's my best answer for that.
Yeah, but I don't know how much you've done the survey, and I see them down here surveying Cod Harbor every time you come up. That beach is getting closer. I mean, you can nearly about, it don't take nothing, you know, the way the beach is moving, and that's going to soon cover the rock there. That's moved 300 to 400 feet, and no doubt, I mean, just this winter it's moved a ton, and that's going to soon just cover it anyway. I mean, it's almost like you will be throwing money right. It wouldn't be no different if you ain't got the cash money you were giving Jerry, just throw it right there on Cod Harbor. I just feel like you'd have a lot of people trying to dredge it up.
Well, we can go out there and take a couple grabs, and you know, I can potentially look at an alternative area there for that. But I don't want to commit to anything just yet. But no, I appreciate the input there.
How many shells do you think Jerry's going to get up from that?
Hopefully, about 10,000 or so is what there might be. Is maybe 15,000 bushels there. Sort of working around the edges still.
Why couldn't you take like a boatload of those? What do you have, 1,300?
Yeah, about 1,200,
1,300. 1,300. Why couldn't you take and plant them on an area on, let's say, either 9 or 10, just to look at it and see what kind of spat set you get, instead of hauling boatload after boatload up there when you get the money and spread them and find out it's not good? I mean, that's just a suggestion, you know.
No, I'd like to see what I've got some plans potentially for 9 and 10, and, you know, that could be a vision there.
I know it's on my grain, and if you get a strike up there like that, it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Potentially look into some more planning up there, but like I said, don't want to commit to anything yet in the area that may or may not be open. But, you know, we're here for the ideas that you guys provide. So.
Well, I think that one, it feeds forward. I guess I'm beating a dead horse, but I'm really against putting these shells here in Powell Harbor. They need to go somewhere else. I mean, they don't need to go here.
I've heard that from a lot of other towns, your boys too, Dan, besides you.
Put them somewhere up there. Put them, Shell Rock, put them somewhere. Just Con Harbor is pointless. It just don't make no sense. That's my opinion.
I guess.
I think that really needs to be reevaluated.
We did have that on this year's replenishment plan already, but, you know, we can make adjustments, but I think the advisory committee was unanimous on that, and I think the commission was too on that part. So, you know, but I think we can, if Jerry's not, you know, if he catches some extra shell, I wouldn't be opposed to trying that or potentially something else up there in 9 and 10 if we can figure out a way to do it, just to see what's going on up there. So that's just a potential rotation here. I think you've seen that map before.
Yeah.
I've been doing a movie for a while, and some of this stuff covered these issues, and I guess in terms of, I want to say congratulations on the position, first of all, I haven't done a chance.
Come up, please.
You can come all the way up there.
You don't need to hide.
Okay.
Thank you. What's your name?
David McGinnis. I guess my question was, I guess one thing that just in the course of my thumbing I noticed in terms of the Rappahannock is that the third man on the boats, specifically the boats that I happen to go on, there were a lot of guys who were Eastern Shoremen, like from Big Charles and other places that didn't really, there's no hand-tong area, anything open for them, and so I know it was a source of employment for a lot of them, you know, to make the trip, and just personal observation that some of them were definitely good, hardworking people, you know. Just in the boats I was on, I did observe that. I guess my question was, and I wanted to ask more specifically Andrew and some others about the specifics of Bird Rock. I don't know if you're going to talk more about it in the final part, but I filmed a lot over there on Saxis Island this winter, and I know that some of the Saxis Islanders were, you know, very opposed, and I've only heard that one perspective at this point in regards to Bird Rock and the shells being taken from there, that they their contention was that area doesn't catch a strike often, but it will catch a strike, and a very big strike when it does, and historically it's been infrequent, but their other big concern was the damage that could be done. That's, I guess, their best peeler potting ground, and that there would be a hole created there that could fill in with sediment, and that also it's very productive with clams. So I know that, you know, in the course of my filming with them, they've hammered on that issue, and that it's an issue they consider an issue for them and their local economy, something that to them was a major issue, and like I said, I haven't gotten Andrew's perspective, or, you know, I haven't gotten more than just what they told me, but it's something that they were very concerned about, so that's one thing I just wanted to ask about this meeting is, you know, potential damage to other fisheries and just the holistic approach to that issue.
I think I can answer your question on that. A lot of people were under the impression they were taking every shell that they planted for replenishment on Bird's Rock. The only thing Jerry's doing is taking the shells that went off on the mud around the rocks. So, I mean, that's what was said, and I thought we got that clear, but I assume not. But, I mean, all the shells that are on the rock are going to stay there. And what just went off on the mud, they're going to dredge them up and take them to Cod Harbor.
That's correct. And when we did it last year.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and I told everybody, you know, just about everybody I know, and they, you know, but that's what the word was at, just what you said, that they were going to take all the shells off Birds Rock that they planted, all those barge loads, and carry them to the Cobb in Tangier. It's just like I said, it's just the ones that went off on the mud. It's not going to do any good.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, last year we planted tens of thousands of bushels there in the Pocomoc, and, you know, I think over 60,000 bushels, I believe. I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but a lot. And, you know, this is a relatively small amount, and hopefully it can do some good in Cod Harbor, potentially other areas if there's still some shells there. But, you know, it's not a lot of movement of oyster shell from those areas, but we don't want to lose that shell, and we can get it for a pretty good price dredged up and do something productive with it. So that's just something to think about. Like I said, we got basically some sort of combination of this going forward, these ideas. And then if there's any further discussion on that in terms of, I mean, we'll come back to this, you know, later, but this is just something to get out there now, start early. This is another potential item of current harvest area there to stagger rotations. These are just imaginary lines right now, but it's options. And then, are there any further discussion on that? Or
okay. I would just go into that, just to be on record, I would like to see that bay area always separated from one and two that you've got in the Great Wacomico, the Blackberry Hangs area. I would always like to see that separated. It's a pretty small amount of boats that work up there, and it's a pretty hard place to work. And you've got guys that go there every year that would take pressure off of one and two. That the one and two guys, a lot of them aren't going to go up there to Blackberry, but the guys that, if Blackberry were closed, they're going to be in one or two.
Bring that in like that.
I would, you know, up in the Reedville area there, a handful of guys that know how to work that. I mean, it's called Blackberry Hangs for a reason. Yeah. So it's
got some stones there on the bottom.
Yeah. And, you know, down the road, if we are able to increase our shell budget, I think that could be an area that really could be productive and enhanced down the road. I know it's difficult now when you're just trying to maintain what you've got, but that area has a lot of potential up there.
Yeah. That's a good point there.
But I had one guy call me today that knew I was coming that said that what you've got in the river needed a rest.
Yeah, I mean, we were, I don't have it right here, but sort of resurveying that area, you can see that got, I mean, it looks similar to that picture I showed you, what's on the bottom there after harvest. There's a lot of, there's oysters there still, but there's a lot of that just hash, ground up shell from heavy pressure there. And that's basically it for my main agenda items. There was some, I had the agenda item there, the legislation issues. That's sort of, if you guys want to talk about that while we're here. I don't think there's any major changes from Virginia legislator in terms of, there was a couple tweaks to notifications for private leases. There's a little change in, you know, if there's a culling violation, you can post your bond in a different way, and then you're required to put your oysters back overboard on public ground. There was some discussion that it may have been happening and that wasn't going on public ground, but that was changed there. I guess there's some dredging stuff in Lynn Haven about private oyster ground, but nothing major from that. And then there's, you know, federal stuff that affects funding, not for VMRC, but some other programs like other scientific agencies that get support through that. But that's not really my wheelhouse, but if you guys wanted to address any of that.
I have one point that I'd like to bring up and would like to see someone make a motion from this committee for it to go to the commission. The one thing that I heard, spent a fair amount of time in Richmond, you know, what's going on positive. We're up there trying to protect this $2 million, and there's 1,000 other people up there looking for $2 million. And the press that continues to come from BMRC is negative. It's about oyster poaching. It's about, so I went back and did some, what I could find, and it looks like 2012 was the last press release that was put out outside of the oyster trail and, you know, the aquaculture thing. But as far as what the $2 million is appropriated for, you know, we're going on close to 6 years since there's been any real positive press. And you guys do have things to be proud of. I mean, that Rappahannock harvest, or just like what you put up on the James, or, you know, the fact that Virginia's back on the map with wild oysters. I would just like to see a recommendation come from this committee to go to the commission. I've brought it up with the commissioner, but we need something positive to go out for these legislators to see that we continually ask to support us, to know and have something to hang their hat on, that I'm recommending this money and it's going for a good purpose. So I just, we've got some things that we could be proud of and get impressed with, and I would like to see that reiterated to the from the PR side of the commission, that we get some positive press out.
I think that's a great idea. Is there a second? You want to make that in terms of a motion, sort of for a...
You motion it?
Sure.
I second it.
So I guess for the recommendation for the shellfish, from the Shellfish Advisory Committee, to recommend that the commission put out a press release highlighting the replenishment program successes.
Just more public.
More public. More positive PR.
Public positive PR.
I'm not belittling the work that law enforcement does, and, you know, they should be proud of what's been done. But, you know, I get customers, these seafood.com now, you get, you know, the minute one of these stories comes up, it gets picked up by seafood.com, and it's all over the country in 15 seconds. And, you know, when I start having customers call me, have you guys got a problem down there? You know, every article that comes out sort of revolves around poaching. So I just think, you know, legislatively it would help. And I also think from a Virginia marketing perspective, it helps to keep us out there on some positives as well.
The legislators,
excuse me, Tom.
I was just going to say, the legislators need to see that there's positive return on their investment more regularly. I think not just one media blitz, but on an ongoing, there's a media person here at VMRC, just have her be creative and start doing more positive press releases about what the money's being used for and how it's increasing the wild fishery.
I'm amazed that, and we had Delegate Cox, who's the speaker at Windmill Point, when Dunn and those guys were down there shaking hands. I mean, we've got, our legislators are proud of our watermen. They just need to hear that, you know, I'm invested in these guys and I'm getting a return. And, you know, continually hearing about the guys that these fellows have to deal with on an ongoing basis. They're unfortunately always been there and always will be there. That's the reason this law is to address those folks. But yeah, enough said. I would appreciate it.
Jim always said that there was a $6 return for every dollar invested in shells.
Right. It's about, yeah.
So,
it's,
I mean, that's a substantial amount of money. And maybe that could be incorporated in what Tommy is saying.
If you can have the watermen projected as the people that they are, which are hardworking men and women just trying to make a living, and we recognize that we have some outlaws just like any other class of people or working people in the country, but quit projecting them as a group to be criminals, and project them as they really are. That's all I got to say.
I think it's important to be fair, and I hope that VMRC isn't projecting watermen as criminals. I don't think that's...
Well, you know, some of the articles I've read, hard to say. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see a more positive publicity from this agency, personally. And I got a lot of time invested in this agency and in this business, and my history goes back generations as a waterman. And I'd just like seeing what's coming from this agency in way of projecting watermen. I know a lot of them, a lot of them, and they're not those kind. Most of them are not the kind of people that are being projected in the press.
I need to vote on that motion.
Okay. Yeah.
Who's second?
I go ahead and call a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. All right. So more positive press there. And was there anything else in terms of, you know, anything going on politically that you guys wanted to talk about while we're all here together that could potentially affect the industry? I guess that's an agenda item, but like I said, you know, if not, unless there's anything else you said you had, is there anything else you wanted to?
I wanted to have the committee discuss a regulation that was imposed back early on, like in the 90s, I think it was. And at the time, it was, I think it was for conservation, and it was to keep from wasting a resource back when things were a little scarcer. But it was when you harvest seed in the James, it has to be, if you harvest seed and put it on your ground, you can't harvest it for 6 months. So I've heard quite a few.
If you harvest seed, yeah, it can't come up till June 1st.
June 1st.
Is the way the regulation reads.
Okay. All right. I've just heard complaints from watermen that if they harvest it and it's theirs and it's lawful, you know, why can't they sell it?
Well, they can sell seed as long as it's not going.
No, I'm talking sell it for market oysters.
The market oysters,
especially with the threat of disease. Now, I can understand way back in the day, they were trying to keep people from just harvesting the bottom and selling everything. But the market is just going to take care of that.
Well, I guess the reason for that was to prevent the potential that exists for people to harvest everything, put it on their ground, come back the next day. And with a dredge and dredge it up.
If it's lawful, if it's a market size oyster.
If it's lawfully planted and they have a market for it, then they should be able to do with as they please. And the intent of the modification of that regulation was people buying seed, putting it on a tractor trailer, running the seed through their house and picking out the big oysters and then planting it. And instead of enforcing the rule that it had to go overboard first, another regulation was modified to avoid a problem. And to plant seed in October and have to wait till May to catch it is, say you miss a shot in the market to make some money at Christmas or New Year's, say it gets warm and the skates show up a month early and you've got the threat of this seed being eaten before you get a chance to put it to the market. It's a major risk planting it itself for the money it costs and the time it takes, and certainly it needs to come off the public and go overboard on the private. There's no question about that. But once that procedure has been done, it's yours to do with as you please, and you should be able to go into it and sell what you can sell. If you can sell in the size of a quarter, if you've got that market, if it was natural strike on your ground, you could do that. So to take something, again, it handicaps the industry.
I can tell you up front, I wouldn't support that for a number of reasons.
You would or would not?
I don't think I could. I wouldn't be behind changing a regulation to do that.
On what grounds?
The way that it's effective right now, the way that it works, is it prevents the problem that could exist from being a problem. So it's ineffective in that mode. And there's
enforce the rule that it has to go back overboard. And then once it's overboard, it's property of the leaseholder, and let them do with it as they choose or what the market will allow them to do.
Well, you can make that an emotion as a recommendation if you want, but I think there's good reasons to not make it so that you can instantly come back after you've planted it overboard and catch it that next day. There's justification and reason for that.
And what justification is that? Just saying
it prevents the temptation that exists from catching the next day, having, you know, since there's a clean cull limit right now on public ground. There's not a seed limit, and that's part of that.
There is an 80,000 bushel seed limit in James River.
There's 120,000 bushels, 40,000 of that, yeah, before.
Anyway.
Right. So, and also allowing those oysters to have time to do what they do is potentially valuable right there. Instead of catching them that right there that next day, as you're, you know, having them right
once
there.
Once they're harvested from that seed area, don't they become the property of the harvester?
We
then to do with as he chooses. Just the same as there's no cull limit on private ground, there's no bushel limit on private ground.
Could it be, instead of having to wait till June, why not change it to 2 months? So if they harvest in October, they can take it up in 2 months, so that they can benefit from.
A reasonable option, I think.
And who's going to keep track of that?
I don't know. I'm just trying to find a compromise.
No, I understand, but in the real world,
yeah, I know.
The record keeping and the work that VMRC already tries to do to keep track of stuff.
Yeah.
Asking them to keep track of that is not going to happen, because you plant 100 bushels today, and then the weather's bad and you miss a week, and then you work for a week and plant whatever you plant that week, and then it's bad again. I mean, it's there's no way to keep track of.
Yeah.
I won't say there's no way, but with the ability that they have to keep track, it would be a nightmare on their part.
Well, that's why having a firm date like that solves that regulatory problem. So there's a lot of other issues.
It makes it easier for the record keeping and a penalty onto the people trying to do something with the seed.
Well, the problem is that where you plant it, you can't harvest anymore either.
You can't continue
your harvest.
It closes that,
closes that ground. That's the problem we had when we were working.
But it doesn't close just the area that you planted it in. So you can still work that
leaf.
If
you planted in that particular area before and you were harvesting it, if you put seed there, you can't go back on there until June, right?
That's correct.
The area that you've marked off, not the whole lease, just the area
that you squared off to plant the seed in. You can harvest outside of that square. But still, it just seems like a wasted opportunity to get 3-inch oysters up that are in there if they paid for it and harvested it instead of having to wait till June.
Well, it's just too much regulation.
I agree.
There'd be.
And well, then, since you made the suggestion, I would make the motion to repeal the June 1st date out of Code Section 4 VAC 20-720-100. Which is the code section that he brought up. I already had that on my list, too.
Is that in code or is it regulation?
Regulation.
Okay.
There's not necessarily, it wouldn't be perfect if you did that. I mean, there's downsides to doing that, and I don't know if the commission would support it, and I'd be hesitant
to find out until it gets there.
Is that a motion?
Can
we make a motion?
It is.
To that effect?
And I just seconded it.
Okay. We got a motion and a second.
Remove the June 1st
date out of that code, out of that regulatory section 4 VAC 20-720-100.
I guess we can call that to vote and then see how we go from there. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
And if that doesn't fly at our next meeting, I would like to at least see it backed up to coincide with the public closing. The complaints that I've heard on this is basically it's going to take the whole month of May with some folks not. The guys that had smaller leases, it's going to take the whole month of May off the table for them. Whereas, you know, if this doesn't fly, at least have it so that when April everything closes on market, they can at least work the month of May to have something.
Yeah. Would you like to add that at all into a sort of an additional recommendation or have that as a separate?
I'd like to hold it out until we see where it goes.
I'd like to be discussed and then we can make another motion.
I'm just bringing it up to the committee that if this doesn't fly, the next time we meet or, you know,
try a different approach.
Or maybe even mention to a commissioner, I might be able to pull that off, that if that doesn't fly, the idea that you could back up to that. But
wouldn't that be more palatable?
I'd be more agreeable to that than
the
next day.
You put that out there, the commission, all of your recommendations. view of your recommendation is going to go with that.
I wouldn't recommend a change, but I'd be more so inclined to that change than...
I understand what you're saying, but they're going to go with your recommendation.
That's not always the case.
Well, I don't want to get in an argument with that.
But is there any other other things that you'd like to address while we're here and got a captive audience? But
I'd just like to say again, I appreciate, you know, we haven't had meetings this early to get out in front of these issues. I appreciate you taking the time to bring this up.
Yeah, welcome aboard.
I would like to ask, just to follow up on what Mr. DeMaria asked as far as the shell dredging, what's the status? I know that was in limbo when we left last time.
I don't think the shell dredge isn't being planned. There's no ownership change going on, and we haven't gotten a firm contract yet, but we're planning on doing it as we've been doing it. So we're anticipating that there's no ownership change, and we'll be digging shell this year and planting shell as proposed in our replenishment plan as of now. So that's what we anticipate today.
When is that set to start?
June 15th.
Did Maryland jump on board with that, or don't you know?
Maryland, they're going to decide on their permitting on Man of War Shoals. I think that decision is supposed to come down sometime in June, and I haven't heard yet one way or another whether they'll permit the dredge going up there and digging shell, but
that'll help keep her in business, you know.
Yeah. There's been some pushback from various sides and agreement from various sides, yeah, so that's sort of pretty up in the air at this minute. Yeah. All right, is there anything else?
Move for adjournment.
Second.
Hey, then, old F. Huh? Keep it straight?
Yeah.
Any appeals yet?
Not yet. 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 Not yet